And joining me right now here on the phone line to kick off the new Major League Baseball season and to talk about his brand new baseball book is my good friend Michael Lortz. Michael, how you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, let's start with the book, man. We'll get to your picks for Major League Baseball in a second. What's this new book you're working on for baseball?
So it was released in November. It's a baseball fiction novel called Curveball at the Crossroads. It's about a young man who hurts his arm, makes a deal with the devil to get back in the game. It's done real well on Amazon, a lot of great reviews. So I'm super excited to have a book signing in Brevard County, Cocoa Village. It's going to be awesome.
How long did it take you to create the book then?
Oh, man, about 8 years. I'm not going to lie. It was something that I had done. I'd started. I work as a government contractor, and I was overseas and missed baseball so much, I just started writing my own story, and which is a fun story in and of itself. And then just life got in the way when I got back home, and it just kind of sat on a hard drive for years. And when the pandemic hit, I was like, well, you know what? Nobody's got any sports. Let me finish this thing up. And I rewrote the ending, put in a couple other chapters and everything, and then used a lot of freelancers to edit it, design the cover and all this stuff, you know, all the production side of bookmaking, and got it out there and finally put a version I like out in the world in November. And I've been super excited. You know, with baseball season coming up, it's, you know, tomorrow, today, it's just a great time to start talking baseball and baseball books.
Okay, wait a minute. In your book, what is the time period? Is it now? Is it the 50s? What did you do?
So that's a great question. And I kind of tried to make it timeless because it has that old country dirt roads, devil at the crossroads feel, you know, like you would see in movies from like the 30s or the 50s and stuff like that. But there's cell phones in it. There's social media, you know, so it's like small town kid, you know, small town Mississippi. But I like to think the sports part of it is modern. I do talk about sports radio. I do talk about sports media. I do talk about these things that embrace the sports cultures now. I talk about owners that are trading players for peanuts on the dollar. You know, so just I talk about these kind of issues that are now in the book, you know, and it's like backstories and everything. So I think it takes place now, but I like to think it's kind of timeless. People have asked me the same question. I'm like, kind of now? So that's a really good question. But I like to think it's something that somebody could pick up in 30 years from now and be like, wow, this is still relatable.
Well, I love the idea where it's he sells his soul to then play again. And my question then is, you must really love baseball.
I'm a huge fan.
Even why do you love baseball? That's my question.
You know, I grew up in the Brevard County area. I played Melbourne Little League for years, and it was always the sport as a kid who I'm a tall left-handed kid. You kind of topped out at 6 foot tall, so that's too short for basketball. I couldn't dribble, but it's great for being a pitcher. You know, so I got into pitching, played Little League all throughout, you know, all through Brevard County Little Leagues, and you know, and then hurt my arm when I was 15. So it's kind of topped out at about 70 miles an hour. And once you get about 15, you're not starting to hit 70s, 80s and above. Your career is pretty much done, you know. So that was the end of my career. And I kind of got into writing and some other stuff that I've made a career out of, some tech. I mean, I work in cybersecurity now and all that stuff. But, no, baseball has always been my love. It's you know, I grew up playing it. My dad was a vendor at Chase Stadium as a teenager. So he brought his love of baseball and conveyed his love of baseball to me. You know, I remember going to see the Marlins 93 or first opening, first inaugural spring training season, going to get autographs from Charlie Huff and all those guys out there in Vieira. So it's always been a love of mine. So for me to write a baseball book was just something natural. You know, I've reconnected with a friend of mine who I hadn't talked to in years. He's like, hey, you finally wrote that baseball novel. I was like, yeah, it's finally out there.
Do you remember where you were 8 years ago when you came up with the idea? Were you in a hotel room? What happened?
No, actually, I was working in Afghanistan. I was as a government contractor in Afghanistan, so, you know, you can't really stay up on current events. You know, you're at least a 12-hour, 8-hour difference. You know, plus your internet connection's pretty bad. So I was just like, you know what? And then the thing about working out there and working government work out there is you work 12 hours on, 12 hours off. You can go to the gym. That burns about an hour and a half of your day. You sleep about 6 hours. What do you do for the other 2 or 3 hours that some people would watch videos, you know, Netflix, DVDs, whatever it is they had? I was like, you know what? I'm just going to write. I've always been a writer. So I was like, I wasn't doing any writing, because as you know, I write a lot about the Rays and the baseball situation here in Tampa Bay. So without that to be able to do, and obviously nobody asking for anything from me content wise, I was like, I'm just going to write my own thing. I came back with about 200 pages of a book and a Word document. And I said, man, this is something. There's something here. Whenever I read it, I kind of get that good feeling that this is a good story. And so it took time for me to edit it and just, like I said, life gets in the way. But when the pandemic happened and life stopped, I said, well, now there's no distractions. Let me finish this thing and rewrite it. And you know, the reviews have been great. People have said, you know, that it's got a really good story to it. You know, and it's, you hear a lot of the deal with the devil stuff. And just to put it with baseball, has been these two American cultural standards put together. And it's filled with little Easter eggs. I put a lot of little cultural Easter eggs. I'm always happy when people find them.
That's really cool, man. Now, you're going to have a book signing coming up. Yeah. Is it May 28th in Cocoa Village? What's going on exactly?
Cocoa Village at a bookstore called Hello Again Books in Cocoa Village. Great people there. I went and visited them around January. And it was just a matter of me sliding into their schedule, post-COVID appearance events and all that stuff. And then they had other authors already booked and everything. So I said, once baseball season starts, let's get me in there. And they said, yeah, it's awesome. So May 28th, we're going to be doing it at a Hello Again bookstore in Cocoa Village. Like I said, great, fun people there. They have a fun little store. And that's been the thing, man. It's been just going out and going to these bookstores. You know, Hello Again here in the end of May. I'm doing a book fair here in Tampa in the end of April. I'm actually going to Mississippi to the blues, the birthplace of the blues, crossroads. The actual physical crossroads are in this rural town in Mississippi. So I'm going there for a music festival here in the end of April too. So it's got me, I work 9 to 5, but it's my fun weekend hobby is to promote this thing. I was just at a brewery signing books last weekend. So drink beer, talk baseball, and sell books, man. That's a perfect day for me.
How many different names did you also have for the title of the book?
You know what? I Curveball at the Crossroads was something I had from day one. And I don't know what it was. I was like, that's what I'm running with. I went through about 5 subtitles. You know, the story of the main character, or the main character takes on the devil, or, you know, this or that. And finally, I was just like, you know what? The title should just stand on its own. It doesn't need a subtitle. So I just went with Curveball at the Crossroads. I thought Fastball at the Crossroads, but Curveball at the Crossroads is just that alliteration of the C's. And I was like, you know, it's a strong title to me. And when I Googled it, nobody had used that title for anything. And I was like, wow.
There you go.
So, yeah, so now it's the only thing that comes up when you Google it. So that's always convenient.
Here's what I love about baseball. I loved your answer. I want you to know mine.
Sure.
So my thing with baseball is it's very pure. 3 strikes, you're out. Can you hit that ball? You know, I feel like today's society, there's a lot of, and there's nothing wrong with this. It's like, no, I'm not in the mood. I'm not feeling it. Can we do this later? Can we do that? Baseball is very simple. Can you hit the ball or can you not hit the ball? And everyone knows that. Everyone.
Sure enough.
Can you hit the ball? And everyone knows 3 strikes and you're out. Every American knows this idea. Even if you don't like baseball. I like the purity, and it's simple. Can you hit the baseball? That's what I like about it, Michael.
Absolutely. You know, you've got 5 things. Can you catch? Can you throw? Can you hit? Can you run? And can you field? You know, can you do the simple things that we require of you on the baseball field? If you can't, and you're not good enough to at least shine on one of the aspects of the game, then it might not be the sport for you.
Well, when you were in Afghanistan, you told people, hey, I like baseball. They're like, we don't know what you're talking about. Is that what happened?
You know, I worked mostly on the base, and I did find a community of like-minded baseball fans, which was really cool. you know, you wake up in the morning, obviously we had this time difference, and, you know, I was there for a whole year, so it was an entire baseball season. Mm. And baseball season was a really good way to mark the time.
Yeah.
Like, okay, good, opening day's coming up. All right, we're already in April. Hey, the All-Star Game's coming up. Oh, man, we're already in July. That's great. Oh, the World Series is coming up. Oh, we're already in the end of October. Man, I'm going home soon. By the time next season starts, I'll be home. So it's just – it's a great way to mark the time. And, you know, James Earl Jones says that in Field of Dreams. It just keeps marching. America changes, but baseball keeps marching on. You know, and that's 100% true. I did throw an Easter egg to James Earl Jones in my book, too. There's a speech that somebody says, and I kind of modified his speech a little bit to fit my character speech. So that's the tributes I have. I have a tribute to Casey at the Bat in the book. I have a tribute to James Earl Jones in the book. A tribute to all these different baseball stories. The Curious Case of Sid Finch, if you're familiar with that one, that plays a role in the book as well. So it's my ode to baseball, and it's my ode to the music and the blues and just popular American culture throughout the entire book.
Do you still have your mitt from when you were a kid?
I think I do. I know I have an old baseball bag full of equipment, and I know it has about two or three gloves in it. And being left-handed, none of my friends were going to steal my gloves. You know, like, I had all right-handed friends. So, you know, they were borrowing their own gloves. And my gloves stayed in the same bag. So, yeah, and I'm pretty sure I still get the same bat. I think the balls were lost, though. I think either they rolled down sewers or gutters or got stuck up in the neighbor's yard or something like that. And, you know, I'd play religiously.
Growing up in the North, Michael, so, like, I grew up in Chicago, so it's like, you know, it'd be the dead of winter, and there'd be snow outside. And I know this is really corny. I would grab my mitt, and I'd smell it, and I'd be like, okay, don't worry. Summer will be around the corner. I would do that from time to time. I think of that.
I grew up, you know, I was born in New York, so I lived in New York for my first 10 years. So this is where I grew up, a Mets fan in the 80s, Gooden, Strawberry, Carter, all that stuff. Mm. Then came down to Florida in the late 80s, early 90s. And so jumped on the Marlins bandwagon real quick right there in Vieira. And then came over to Tampa Bay and start, you know, that's my latest adopted team. But, you know, still room for the Marlins because they're another state team. And still room for the Mets because that's my childhood team. But we had baseball 24/7. The only time we didn't play is when we saw lightning. And obviously, you know, lightning storms in Florida, everybody just stays inside. So, but that was it, man. That was the only time we didn't play. We played every day. And that's probably the reason why I hurt my arm when I was about 15 years old, is because you only genetically have so many throws in your arm, you know?
Yeah.
And I timed out at 15. The other guys, you know, pro athletes time out. Nolan Ryan timed out at 45, you know, 46 years old. I timed out at 15. So
it's
that's okay, man.
Look,
I draw.
Dude, I'll still be your friend. It's okay. Don't worry. It'll be all right.
No, I hope you can make it to Hello again. It'd be great to see you there.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Okay. Let's talk some Rays baseball then.
All right, yeah, let's do it.
We talked last fall, and now we have the update where I believe they're not going to go to Montreal. What?
No, that is dead in the water. That is absolutely dead.
Why was that even allowed to be an idea? I don't understand.
So Stu Sternberg, the billionaire ideist that he is, businessman, had this idea of splitting the season and that two municipalities would spend hundreds of million dollars each on two baseball stadiums, and he would not have to spend an entire baseball stadium, and he would split it. Maybe he would pay a third, maybe he would pay a half, but he would get two markets. And in order to compete against Boston and New York, which are mega markets, I mean, they're not just small markets. They are mega, the biggest markets in Major League Baseball. He thought that he would need two TV deals, two attendance bases, two of everything. And so on a business, if you were to just write it down on a piece of paper and say, look, market A plus market B is going to give me the size of market C, and that's going to let me compete with the size of New York, or the team, you know, the budget of the Yankees and the budget of the Red Sox. Okay, but it does not pass the reality test that you have two fan bases and two social environments that fans get very fickle, you know, and if you have to constantly pet them on the head and give them love. And the Tampa Bay market was just being neglected and shunned by the new kid, the Montreal idea. And it was just Major League Baseball entertained it for a little while and then just told him, no, you've got a growing market there in Tampa Bay. All indications, our population's up, our income's up. There's buildings going up all over Tampa Bay like there are all over the I-4 corridor. You know, like, make it work here. If the NFL can work here, the NHL can work here, you can make it work here. So he had to pull the plug on this idea, and Tampa Bay went nuts. We were just like, woo, you know, it was like the witch is dead, you know, and the Wizard of Oz, you know. So just to get that off the plate. So now where they sit is trying to find a location in the Bay Area where the majority of population can go to a game conveniently. And that's been a difficult struggle for them. So that's kind of where we're at now. And then we'll talk about how are they going to pay for it. You know, you want to get the cart and the horse in the right order, but at the same time, both of those boxes need to be checked. They need to figure out how they're going to pay for this thing. They need to figure out where they're going to put it.
Michael, I talked about this with the guests yesterday, where the Rays are not alone. We have a team out in California with the same problem with Oakland, where they got a great organization. They're making the playoffs, and the stadium's it's a dumpster. Like, what is? I don't get how Major League Baseball can let this happen to two different markets. I don't get it. It's a NBA doesn't have this problem, NFL doesn't have this problem. Why is baseball sitting around? I don't get it. And you know, my parents, they went to a Lightning game last Friday night. They loved it. They go downtown. Yeah, they go downtown. It's great scenery. Everyone can go. It's right there. Why can't we just figure that out for the Rays? Put them in downtown Tampa. I don't understand. I don't get it.
You know, but then it becomes a land issue. And they've been looking at Ybor City, which is, you know, a mile from downtown Tampa, if that. And you could take trolley cars and setting up that public infrastructure. But then that becomes, okay, there's a couple acres here. We can put a baseball, 100 acres or whatever they need for a baseball stadium. Okay, we could put it here. We can use public parking garages. Most of the traffic for a ball game is going to be after 5. If it's a day game, where do we put people? How, you know, because you got people that are working, taking up the parking garages. Where are we going to put the, you know, what's the flow and inflow and inflow and outflow of traffic? Amalie Arena is an amazing place. And they have just really built up around it to make the Lightning an experience. I went there in February. And actually, I brought my nephew who lives in the Melbourne area to his first ever game.
Nice.
And he was like, man, he loved it. And it's just going to be difficult to fit a baseball stadium. You know, back in the day, Fenway Park, Wrigley Field, those stadiums have just legacy in those locations, and they've built up and down real estate around them. With the Rays, they're going to have to try and figure out what land is left because the owner of the Lightning, not only does he own the property or lease the property for Amalie Arena, he bought all these spare parking lots around it and put up hotels and apartment buildings. He is becoming a very, very rich man because of real estate in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, it's a good point. They deserve to have a nice stadium. I didn't like their idea for Ybor City where it was this smaller ballpark either. I thought that was trash. Build a real ballpark. No. That's nonsense.
Yeah, but give us at least 30,000 because, you know, like you, if you want to host an all-star game, you're going to want to showcase and you're going to want to bring in fans from all over the country to showcase an all-star game. You know, like you're going to want 35, 40,000 people to come see your home run derbies and stuff. If you have a stadium that's too small, 20,000 people, Major League Baseball is never going to consider you for an all-star game. No matter how big your population in your city is, if you try to get it too small, you can never get bigger. And then with World Series tickets, if the Rays make the World Series and they only hold 20,000 people, how expensive are those tickets going
to
be?
I was about to bring that up with you. I'm sorry. It's a trek to get over to St. Pete, and the tickets are not cheap either to go to a Rays game. It's ridiculous.
They used to be. They used to be, and I'll give them credit. They used to have you pop into 7-Eleven, and you buy anything at 7-Eleven, a bottle of water, a stick of gum, and you can buy Rays tickets in the upper deck for $7.11. It was an amazing deal. I just grab a bottle of water, drink the bottle of water as I'm on my way to the game. Sit up in the upper deck, $7.11. Can't go wrong. What they did though is they closed the upper deck, limited the amount of seating, and they did this in 2018 or 19, so it's even pre-COVID. And everybody was like, "Where are the cheap seats now?" And they're like, "Well, we're increasing demand." I'm like, "But you're killing the cheap seats. What? again, the fan base has just been it's a scarred fan base right now because of all just the bad decisions that the Rays have made marketing-wise in thinking that this idea is going to work and this idea is going to work. It's like, just open it up, make the cheap seats, you know, available, and let us just go to the games. You know, let me pull out $40, you know, or something, and spend $40 on a ticket, parking, and a beer, and, you know.
Yeah, you're good.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, but then here's what's interesting. We're here with Michael Ortz. I appreciate coming out. We're talking Rays baseball right now. And get his book, by the way. This is very key. But then on the field, they're fantastic. And the fact that they compete against the Red Sox and the Yankees is a Disney movie. It's phenomenal. Yes. How do they do it year in and year out? I don't get it. Because honestly, who they trade? Austin Meadows the other day? Like what is going on here exactly?
You know, they have a philosophy. And regarding Meadows, real quick,
yeah.
He kind of started to fall out of the philosophy. And they don't like – the Rays like the utility guys. The Rays like these guys that can play three or four positions. They can rotate guys around. They can have a guy play second base and center field. And Austin Meadows is not a great center fielder. He's a left field, right field, or DH guy. But to give you about 20, 30 home runs, low average, a lot of strikeouts. And the Rays were like, well, that's kind of a one-dimensional player for us. We like guys who can do multiple things. And so they traded him for a utility infielder out of the Tigers organization. I'm not sure where this guy's going to fit in. They are loaded in the infield with young talent right now. So I'm really not sure where he's going to fit in. But Austin Meadows had kind of wore himself out of the Rays' philosophy. Now, Meadows came in the Archer trade where they got Glasnow and Meadows and Shane Baz, which was a totally ripped off Pittsburgh. But that's what they do, is they trade high. So they always trade guys. And as the fans were disappointed, but they always tend to trade high. Then they trade high, get a bunch of prospects. Two or three of them will pan out. In the case of the Meadows trade, they got Meadows, Glasnow, and Shane Baz, who I think made the starting rotation, but he was a stud in the end of last season when they called him up. So they just got prospects and everything and young players, and they stay young, and they're always looking at those pre-big contract guys to just cycle in young talent, and they have a philosophy, and their pitching and their analytics, the way they coach their pitchers to do something that no other pitchers and the hitters are expecting, like whether it's throw high fastballs or low curveballs or whatever it is that they've scouted that major league batters are having trouble hitting, is what they tell their pitchers that to throw, or they acquire pitchers that throw it. It's fascinating watching their roster construction. It's a little maddening from a fan perspective.
Yes.
Because you can't really get attached. But it's fascinating to watch. Oh, they just acquired this guy. Well, what does he bring to the table, and how are they going to use him? It's very much a video game type of way. But
you know what? Very nice analogy. I agree with you. It's incredible. They won the division. I mean, they won the pennant 2 years.
100 games.
Yeah, 100 bleeping games for this team. Yeah. They
amazing.
You know, as a broadcaster, I really respect the Rays because I understand that's what I do for a living. Mark, there's no budget. Make it work.
Yeah, exactly. And they are. And now how much of that, so it really draws to the question of how much is Stu Sternberg profiting from this team? And that's the ongoing not discussed thing in the Tampa Bay area, or that people ask, but the Rays, of course, are hush-hush because they're a private business. We understand that. But how much of the money is he taking, and then how much of it could he put into the team to give them $5 million more or $10 million more to spend on players? You know, they re-signed Wander Franco to this mega deal. I mean, it's the richest contract in Rays history by far. But could they afford to get somebody else? Could they re-sign somebody else to a long-term deal instead of trading them, or, you know, whatever else they have? And how much is Sternberg keeping out of his own? Because the business is going to be the business. You know, they get revenue from TV, they get revenue from ticket sales. But how much of that is he skimming off the top? Because as the owner of the business, you kind of expect him to at least make some money on it. Mm-hmm. But I wonder where that percentage is. You know, is he taking 5% off the top? Is he taking 20% off the top?
See, I agree with you because we had a dispute where we had the lockout there. We had a lockout. My thing is like, how are they in the same universe as the New York Mets right now? What is their payroll this year? Over 200.
Oh, it's insane.
It's insane. I'm telling you, if I'm these owners, why am I spending all this money? I'm so confused sometimes how the Rays exist in the same universe, like I said, as these other teams. You know,
You have owners like the Pirates who just are putting bad products out year in and year out on a beautiful stadium in downtown Pittsburgh. I mean, absolutely one of the jewels of stadiums in Major League Baseball. But they just put a crap product out every year and don't care because they're getting their TV money. They're getting their, you know, some revenue of fans, not a high level of fans, but they're getting enough fans to pull a profit. The owner walks out, counts his money, brings it to the bank, and doesn't really invest in the team on the field product. The Rays front office, you know, they're making diamonds out of coal every year. But what if Stu Sternberg were to give them plastic instead of coal? You know, like, or give them, you know, silly putty or whatever other kind of material, whatever you want to say. But they're making diamonds out of it. They're smarter than the Pittsburgh front office. But is that because they're just hiring smarter people, or is that some kind of overarching philosophy? Or what are they doing right that other small budget teams, you know, Oakland, same way. Oakland always pulls out winners, you know, and they trade guys like Matt Olson, et cetera, but they get, you know, a batch of young prospects and one or two of them hit. So they do a good job in that regard as well.
You're absolutely right, man. Okay, before I let you go, and I appreciate you coming on. Okay.
Yeah, man, thank you.
What's the name of the book and how can we check it out?
So the name of the book, again, is Curveball at the Crossroads. It is available on Amazon. It's available at BarnesandNoble.com. It's available any online place you can get. Walmart.com even carries it. But as for physical copies, right now, Hello Again Bookstore in Cocoa Village has a copy. They should have it. They may have a copy. I gave them a copy in January. I will be there, though, May 28th. That's a Saturday at 1 p.m. selling and signing books, selling and signing copies of Curveball at the Crossroads. But if you can't make it or if it's raining or whatever and you just want to get it online, CurveballAtTheCrossroads.com is the website. It's available Amazon or any other fine bookstores.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on, and enjoy opening day.
Yeah, man, you too. Thank you for having me.